Matt Sullivan here to remind you to stop putting screens on your gutters. Better to schedule a free estimate with the local experts at Gutter Helmet so you stay off the ladder. Visit gutterhelmetindy.com. With Gutter Helmet, you'll never clean your gutters again. gutterhelmetindy.com.
So that governor's debate was a complete disaster, and our next guest says it's time to bounce the debate commission altogether. 93 WIBC, it is the Kendall and Casey Show. I'm Rob Casey's here, and let's welcome in, man, you want to talk about a guy with some political experience and experience with the debate commission. He has been a part of the Indiana State Republican Party. He's worked for Dan Coats' campaign. He's worked for Eric Holcomb's campaign, and he says the debate commission, it's a big problem. Our friend Pete Seat. Hello, Pete.
Well, good morning, Rob and Casey. Good to see you both.
All right, so a little bit of background. You were a comms guru for the state Republican Party. You worked for the Dan Coats campaign when he was a U.S. senator. You worked for Holcomb's campaign. You've been in front of this debate commission, and you've said, look, it's a much bigger problem than just the moderator, that John Swanes guy. It's the whole debate commission collectively.
Absolutely, and quite frankly, I think the moderator, not just in this most recent debate, but in previous debates, is set up for failure.
Interesting.
And I have been saying for years that the debate commission should be either entirely disbanded or completely reorganized. On that Dan Coats campaign, I was the one negotiating with the debate commission during our primary and general election debates.
How's that work? What do you mean negotiating?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're talking about the kinds of podiums and whether you can bring notes on stage and, you know, how long each response and rebuttal is. The most ridiculous thing is they tried, I can't remember if it was Holcomb or Coats campaign, but they tried to prevent the campaigns from recording their own candidates during the post-debate press conference. They didn't even want us to have a record of what our candidate was saying.
Well, you mentioned, okay, negotiations, and I guess at the end of the day, you all come to an agreement. This is the format. This is what we're going to do. But it appears what happened in this debate, that they changed the format while it was happening.
Completely disorganized, haphazard. And this is par for the course. We experienced the exact same thing both times. And I'm quick to point out that this is not about the individuals. I know a lot of the people on the debate commission over the years, they have changed. But as you said, Rob, collectively, as an institution, as an organization, they are incapable of providing this public service. And in doing so, are providing a disservice to the public.
Okay, so here's it. By the way, Pete Seat's our guest. He's worked for the Indiana State Republican Party. He's worked for Dan Coats. He's worked for Eric Holcomb. We're having this conversation about this train wreck of a debate the other night. And this is what's interesting to me, Pete. It is very rare that you will see radical right-wingers like me, more establishment guys like you, and even the mainstream media all agree on anything. But universally, we were all saying that was totally unacceptable what happened the other night.
Well, there's nothing wrong with people agreeing on something, Rob.
It's just so rare.
Some might think this is the final sign of the apocalypse that you and I are in the same room together. But I would also add, you know, something that's always irked me about the debate commission is they hide behind the fact that, you know, the questions are submitted by the public.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, I was not the guy from Brownsburg that did the question on property taxes.
No joke, that was my first thought. I'm like, oh, Rob Kendall, he's everywhere.
No. How did they get in?
But they hide behind that. And I know from firsthand experience that there are special interest groups who spam the debate commission with questions. And I haven't orchestrated it, but I know what's occurred. Anyone could. Like, you spam it and they're like, oh, well, you know, 15% of the questions we got were on this completely obscure issue that no one cares about. So we're going to ask the candidates for governor this question. And it happens. They're prone to manipulation in that way.
Okay, so the commission's made up of mostly academics and journalists, and you have said that they lack the experience. Who in your mind, would be better served to be on the commission?
I think folks like me. I'm not saying I should be on it, but I think people who have
You're going to fit in great on this show.
But people who should, or who have been on campaigns, who have been in a debate prep with a candidate. And I just want to make sure everyone knows, candidates take debates very seriously.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem here is when you switch up the rules in the middle of the debate, these candidates have sat in a room and prepared for the 30-second answer, the one-minute answer, and you can't change that stuff.
Yeah, but you also have to think, if they're running for governor, they've been doing this for a while, they've been on the campaign trail, they ought to be able to ramble on for at least a minute and a half about where they stand on certain topics and their policies and make it pretty clear. Like, if they can't do that, perhaps they should not be running.
Yeah, but they also don't necessarily have an internal clock. They're not as skilled as you two knowing exactly when the commercial break is coming.
We can hit the post. We can hit the post.
And, you know, they don't necessarily know that. And so, yeah, they can answer. Any politician can talk. But I'll tell you what I tell every single candidate I've done debate prep with. Once you say what you have to say, shut up.
Yeah. Stop talking.
Yeah. Done. Because nothing good comes from what you
Pete,
say next.
Pete Seed is our guest. He's been a part of the state Republican Party. He's worked for Dan Coats, worked for Eric Holcomb. We're talking about this just train wreck of a governor's debate the other night. And Pete says, hey, the debate commission that put it on, it's got to go. This is what I don't understand, is why Republicans would give such power to a guy who works for public broadcasting. And I've never understood this on a national level, and I don't understand it on a state level. There's so many great Republican or conservative minded broadcasters in this state. Why wouldn't you insist that someone who kind of at least shares your worldview, who maybe doesn't have a clear favorite, and look, a lot of times with commentators, I'll tell you who they like, but they let a PBS guy who clearly was adversarial to the majority of people on the stage and went out of his way to let everybody know he was adversarial moderate this debate? Why would the state party agree to any, or the candidates agree to any of that?
Well, yeah. I was going to jump in there and say it's the candidates. The state party likely had nothing to do with this.
So
the candidates are making the agreement.
So those six people are like, John Swannis, we like him? Really?
I mean, I'm not going to rag on John. As I said at the beginning, I think that moderators are set up for failure because of how disorganized this entire process is. I would also add, you know, candidates are not without fault here. A lot of candidates will also, in their own way, hide behind the debate commission so they don't have to do other debates. So they don't have to do a WIBC debate and a WRTV debate and a THR debate. And so that they can say, oh, well, everyone, the entire media ecosystem is working together with the debate commission. We're just going to do that one or two or three debates.
Do you think that they can also blame a poor performance on the commission?
In terms of how poorly executed that debate was, potentially. And I think the reason why this moderator was chosen, to go back to that, is previous debates have utilized academic moderators.
Yeah.
And they obviously have a very even-keeled approach to how they moderate a debate. But they don't necessarily have the broadcasting experience that someone who's been on television, either as a reporter or as a host, journalist, might have. Because there's a lot of, you know, if you've moderated something, you know, there are a lot of different pieces you need to juggle at once, right? It's not just ask a question, wait for a response, go to the next question. And I think that's why they made the shift, because there was a lot of criticism of having the academics running these debates. But to your point, Rob, I think if the debate commission moves forward, they need to completely retool it. They need to reassess who is moderating these debates, who's selecting the questions, who's at the table making these decisions, and maybe even listen to the campaigns themselves.
Because this is not rocket science. Like, Casey moderated a debate I had with Jamie Rittenour. And we gave one day's leeway. We're like, oh, this would be fun to do. And they said, sure, we'll do it. And she did infinitely better than this guy that had all these resources at her disposal. Just like Casey Daniels moderate the next debate. She's very fair.
Fine.
She can do better.
I endorse.
And I look good on camera. No, well, you had said that they're disorganized and haphazard. So what would your approach be to, if the commission stays around, which I imagine it will, what is your approach to have a better outcome in the future?
Well, number one, they shouldn't tell the candidates, as they did the other night, that there are no closing statements, and then
well,
ask
sure.
them to give closing
yeah, that's
statements.
Change the format on the fly.
We'll just start there. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. You absolutely cannot do that. And there's just like silly little things. I don't know if they do it anymore, but they had a mandatory, this was in the contract, a mandatory meeting with all the candidates immediately before they went on stage. And so they're all standing together in a little circle in the wings. You know, they're all getting mentally prepared to go out there and to do their best job. And here they have to have this awkward interaction where the debate commission just pretty much wanted FaceTime with all the candidates. So I think if they move forward, they should, I don't know who a conservative host would be or if there's ever a Democrat debate. I don't know, you know, Jennifer McCormick can debate herself.
They'd have to get more than one candidate.
Yeah, she can debate when she was a Republican and debate when she was a Democrat. I don't know. But just, you know, bounce back and forth, podium to podium. But I really do think they need to bring different voices to the table, people who have been there and done that. Just as I know the Presidential Debate Commission is not perfect, guys, but look at who's on that debate commission. You have people who have been through the ringer, who understand how campaigns work. Mitch Daniels used to be on that commission.
Wow. Yeah, you get the last question, Casey.
Well, I'm just wondering if this is a case of attrition or what's going on. Did you have issues during Coates or Holcomb's campaign with the commission?
Absolutely. And I didn't have time to go back through my Twitter feed, but I'm pretty sure I've said similar things and just took the opportunity of yet another train wreck. I mean, I probably could have set that tweet up on a timer to just go out because I knew what was coming. It wasn't going to be worthwhile. So this is not a new stance. This is me being a broken record, and hopefully something will finally happen.
I just found it super interesting that it was some bizarro moment where all the worlds came together, where Pete and me and, you know, I saw Adam Wrenn tweeting about it. And it's like you have all the factions agreeing that this is unacceptable. And I thought we've got to talk about this because how often do we get this opportunity, Pete, where we all agree?
We need to go back to arguing.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Pete, thanks, buddy. Appreciate you, man.
Thank you.
You're listening to Kendall and Casey on 93 WIBC. Money. If I won the lottery, I'd do it tomorrow. We're talking about retiring. It would have to be a big lottery win to make that happen, though. It is Kendall and Casey on 93 WIBC. According to a new AARP study, more than one in four U.S. adults over the age 50 say they never expect to retire. 70% of these people, they're concerned about the rising prices.
That's a pretty depressing abyss to be looking into, isn't it? Because part of having never been an old person, but getting closer each day. Did you ever have that moment where you're sitting around going, I wonder if there have been more yesterdays than there are tomorrows? Like there's a certain point in your life where you math just tells you that's reality. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting into that age where it's like, I'm kind of starting to get into that.
You're on the other side.
What's the life expectancy of a normal American man type of thing?
How much time do I have left?
But, there reaches a point where you say to yourself, okay, I've worked my whole life and getting on in years, hopefully even in good health. You say, I'd like to enjoy the time I have left doing the things that I enjoy the most, which I would think would add to your life expectancy if you're doing things you enjoy. But the reality is, and we're not even talking about, you know, it used to be, hey, grandpa's been retired for 10 years and he's bored. He's going to go work, you know, Saturday mornings at Menards because he likes home construction.
Right.
It's not one of those things. We're talking about people who are having to get quasi or in some cases even full-time jobs who are, you know, 65, 70 years old. That's not the way it was sold to them it was going to be.
Well, when you're talking about people, I mean, and this is a choice that many people are having to make because of everyday expenses. You've got your housing costs or rent, mortgage, whatever it is. These are some of the big reasons why people are unable to save for retirement. But you've got to make these choices all the time. Can I put a couple bucks into savings or am I going to live for the now?
Right.
And if you have chosen the live for the now, you know, if you've chosen that path, guess what? You're not going to have a soft landing as you get older.
You know, it's a fascinating thing. And a lot of it, again, comes back to a total lack of planning. Mm-hmm. Some of it is beyond planning and, you know, hey, life events, people get laid off from jobs, whatever. But, you know, Bill Demery and I had this conversation and, you know, I told him, I said, man, I feel so far behind the eight ball because I've always been good at saving money, but not great at investing it or kind of making the money work the way it should have. And he said, you're still very young compared to a lot of people that walk in my door.
Well, that had to make you feel good.
Well,
there's still time for you, Rob Kendall.
But it's like, wow, you know, so I've kind of started. One of the reasons I work on the weekends is to try to create some sort of retirement option that will exist.
Yes, but in today's economy, now you're actually probably using that money just to offset inflation.
This is the thing. My wife and I have had this conversation. I said the intent of that was, okay, well, I'll do this and I'll do it relatively part-time. But then everything has just exploded in terms of expense that you're right, Casey. A bunch of my part-time money now goes to living daily.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at the statistics, in the past 4 years, energy prices have increased by 38%, gas 47%, electricity 29%, groceries 21%. So everything has gone up. And according to this AARP study, they say that 1/3 of older adults have a credit card balance of over $10,000 and 12% have a balance of over $20,000.
That's staggering because when that's happening, you're throwing money away. I mean, you're literally just lighting money on fire with interest and penalties or whatever every single year. And so that, or month and year, if you keep it going that long. And so that's just money that just evaporates. It disappears. Here's the other concerning thing is it used to be the idea of, okay, if I put my money in some sort of retirement plan, you're going to make your money work for you and it's going to create the stable environment going forward. Inflation is so great that your accounts in many cases have to do so well that oftentimes, even if your accounts do reasonably well by historical standards, you're barely beating inflation.
That's not historical today.
Right?
You can't count on that now. So nearly 40% of people are worried just about meeting their basic living costs, like food and housing. So when you consider all that, it's hard to actually save. And if you're over 50 and you're just starting the saving process and you're doing it in our current climate, You're really under the gun with that one.
And then you have things like, you know, let's say you have some sort of unforeseen illness or accident that impedes your ability to work. Yes, you may have some sort of workman's comp or whatever, but in a world where inflation, again, continues to burn and is totally out of control, the other part of this, Casey, is that people now are largely, middle-class people, are largely stuck in the sense of, people like me who bought our home a couple of years ago got way better interest rates than they could get today. And, you know, I made it my life's mission to get the heck out of Warehouseburg there on the west side as soon as humanly possible. But the reality is, if you had an interest rate in the high twos or low threes, and unless you can sell your home and cash it out and pay cash for your next dwelling, you can't. A middle-class person cannot go from 3% to 7%.
Right.
And so it's a real struggle. And we need to get Mark Dietl back on and talk with him about that because kind of what the barriers to access are. And I know we do that every couple months because I remain amazed. The inventory is low, but I think there's a mixture of reasons inventory is low. And then that creates higher prices. And then you have higher prices with higher interest rates. And it's just it just seems like everyone just feels very unable to move forward in almost every aspect of this economy right now.
I read something recently, which I thought was really interesting, and it was the opposite of what you've heard for years. You know, for a long time, you heard, okay, this couple, they've owned this big family home, and they have adult children, and now they're going to downsize into something smaller. But this article said, don't do that. Don't sell the big house anymore. Don't downsize because now the adult children are coming back home and you're going to want the space.
That's okay. And, you know, you and I have gone around and around on this, which is, you know, there are people who, for a variety of reasons, end up living back at home with an elderly parent. In many cases, it's, hey, you know, mom and dad were married for 50 years and sadly dad has passed away and mom's 80 years old or 70 years old and needs, you know, somebody to look after her. It's not this thing people always get painted like you're 50 years old and you still live at home. That used to kind of be a thing where you'd go, well, that's rather sad. But now with the economy and with the inability of our older, you know, generation, maybe to be able to pay for things. The idea of pooling money and creating an environment where everybody can, you know, mix resources it's not as crazy as it used to be. And it's certainly not just, hey, Fred's 50 and doesn't want to work.
Yeah. I think it's okay. There used to be, you know, a long time families were very close knit. They stayed together and you lived near each other. And then as more people became more educated and employment opportunities became available elsewhere, children would move farther away from their family or their parents. And now I think there's some people that are going back to the older way of, you know, we want to be near mom and dad and close to the family, so much so maybe even in the same house. This survey said that a third of respondents believe their finances will be better in a year.
And let's face it, Casey, I do very few things right, but I figured out the living situation.
Yeah,
perfect.
You did. Right next door.
Yeah, so I don't have to see my dad whenever I don't want to, but anytime I need something... Hey, you home?
Well, and
I can see you in there.
There's also another looming issue that is hanging over a lot of Americans, and that is the ability to retire based on the financial health of Social Security.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that's hanging around, especially people like Kevin's age.
You should count on, Kevin should absolutely plan on getting nothing. I mean, you and I, we might be able to suck a little bit out of it, but Kevin... you're going to get totally, totally hosed.
Yeah, I'm not getting my hopes up.
There's nothing there for you, little Kevin.
But lucky
thanks
for
your money. We appreciate
you
it.
You still get to pay into it.
Yeah, no kidding.
You won't get to reap the rewards. It is Kendall and Casey on 93 WIBC, and we've got a couple voicemails coming up next.
It's time to hear from you. Kendall and Casey present Voicemails. Brought to you by QC Kinetics for non-surgical regenerative medicine treatment at 317-559-PAIN.
The phone number, 317-684-8444. Kevin, working on a new intro for your voicemails. Good job.
Thank you. Yeah, I was getting tired of the blondie, so
yeah.
I wanted to switch it up a little
bit. Switch it up just a bit. I like it. Freshen. Okay, so this is the part of the program that we turn over to you, and we start with a call about Nikki Haley. She took a bit of a bite out of the GOP primary voter base in Pennsylvania, despite dropping out over a month ago. And here's the call.
So I have a question for Rob. Last night was the Pennsylvania Republican primary. I don't know if you guys are going to talk about this on today's show, but last night was the Pennsylvania Republican primary. And Nikki Haley, who is no longer in the race, received over 150,000 votes, I think close to 160,000 votes. Do you think that bodes ill for Trump in Pennsylvania, that almost 160,000 people, even though technically he's the only choice, still voted for her? Do you think that bodes ill for him in the general election? I know they have the mass unaccountable mail-in voting in Pennsylvania, but if 157,000-ish people don't want to vote for you when you're kind of the only choice, but I'm not sure if that bodes well for Trump in the general.
Well, okay, I think a couple things. I think people protesting in a primary is different than whether they'll protest in the
general
election.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it would be the same thing on the Democrat side. I mean, if there was some super contested race where there's a bunch of people who would vote against Biden in protest and then vote for him in the fall, I think the bigger issue remains that in places like Pennsylvania, you have no idea who's voting.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea who's filling out ballots. And if you don't have any idea of who's filling out the ballots, then you have no institutional control over the whole process.
I think it does raise some questions about how sincere some of those voters are going to be in supporting Trump. But when you look at the big picture, 157,000, that's only 17%.
Well, look here, and here's
Trump got 80%.
I mean, you know me, I always share my ballot. I have no problem doing that. I'm not going to vote for Trump in the primary. I'm not going to vote for any of these people because none of them are running and Trump didn't earn my vote. Trump not showing up to those debates, he didn't earn my vote. He didn't put effort in, you know, the things that you would expect of someone who wants to be president of the United States. Now, I'm going to vote for the Trump in the general. Yeah, because it's Trump or Biden. You got, you know, and Kennedy may be a choice, but he's a lunatic on things like the environment. So unless somebody else pops up that really wows me away, I'm going to vote for Trump, but I'm not going to vote for him in the primary because I don't feel like he earned my vote. So I wouldn't read too much into that. I would certainly read into, though, in Pennsylvania, you have no idea who's voting.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. We've got the ramp metering that's going to begin soon, starting in early May. Drivers merging on I-65, they're going to have those stoplights to contend with, letting them know in certain areas if they can proceed onto the highway or not. And somebody wants to let us know they have this already where she lives, and she wants us to know where this could go.
Earlier in the week, I believe you guys were talking about how Indiana is giving the red light cameras and that kind of stuff on the freeways, I believe, and your on-ramps. Let me tell you, I live on the West Coast, and we've had these for years, and they started off just, seriously, just if you ran a red light, that you were ticketed. And, you know, they started with the on-ramp ones also, and those are on during rush hour. Most people stop, some people run them, it's just kind of how it goes. But back to the red light cameras, if you cross over the line when it's red, it's when you're ticketed. But after they implemented that, then they started in on if you turn right on a red without coming to a complete stop behind the crosswalk line, you're ticketed if you don't stop completely. If you kind of do a rolling stop at that red on going right, you're ticketed. And then they implemented speed cameras on those red lights. So if you're going, I believe it's 10 or 11 miles over the speed limit, you're ticketed. And so it's just, they kind of put a light in and then they just keep adding more and more to it.
So that's, of course, the problem that a lot of people have, the issue, like, where does it stop? Now, I think the difference here is that the sensors are on the ground that are going to activate the red lights.
Yeah, well, so for now, red light cameras are banned in the state of Indiana. Like, there's if you go to a traffic light, there's no. Now, when I lived in Wilmington or outside of Wilmington, they had them there, and that was 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and they had them there. So some states do. Like, it's never going to end. This is the point on all this, and I've not seen really any proof. I've heard from multiple listeners in other states that have these ramp lights, mm-hmm. and how little good they actually do. And you know, you and I talked about just the other day that it's not something that you can fix by just going, well, we'll help traffic merge and that'll be better. There's too much traffic. There's too many people. There's too many cars. And you're talking a massive overhaul of infrastructure that the state does not have the ability to pay for. And even if they did, they don't have the manpower to erect it in order to fix this issue. You have to stop building like things are going out of style and then maybe allow infrastructure to catch up with the growth. But the growth is always exceeding any infrastructure upgrade.
So this is a $9 million pilot program that they could have just lit that money on fire.
It's going to solve absolutely nothing.
But it will.
But it will probably be a gateway to what this lady's talking about, ways to fine you or ticket you or whatever. I mean, I think that's probably the next logical step.
Okay, here's a phone call about the Republican debate from the other night.
I listened to you earlier about the debate, which I watched in full. And just call it out for what it is. That moderator, that liberal hack moderator, or rhino at best, was posing just a bunch of gotcha questions, focusing on abortion, immigration, anything to denigrate those candidates and get them to say something that they didn't want to say.
Okay, so we were told that he was chosen because he was mostly neutral.
Huh. Yeah, he was mostly neutral. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Methinks whoever came up with that doesn't understand what the definition of neutral is. And look, we're going to have Abdul on at the end of the show, and we'll get into this, and we'll probably move on from it. But, you know, we talked about it with Pete's seat earlier. Mm-hmm. We talked about it with Merritt. Klopp and I did a bunch on it yesterday. That was a disgrace. But the Republicans do this to themselves. How many times do we see in the national debates where they've got, remember when Candy Crowley, I think it was, threw the yellow flag or red flag or whatever on Mitt Romney during the debate? I mean, you see these these activist moderators go into the business for themselves, but ultimately it's hard to blame them for being what they are. It's, again, it's the vampire argument. If you're going to let a vampire into your house, you don't get the right to complain when the vampire does the vampire thing, which is drain your blood. And they keep letting these PBS type people have influence and sway over Republican functions. I have no idea why they would allow somebody like that to do that. Why? I mean, all the conservative commentators, I mean, you could add someone like Tony Kennett could have done it, who's, I think, pretty neutral. I mean, clearly, they're never going to have somebody like me. I'm too inflammatory. I say too many bad things about all these candidates. But you could have these conservative commentators. I mean, you could think of a whole bunch of them. You know, there's a very conservative radio station up in Fort Wayne that people, you know, love to listen to up there. There's a million options of, like, legitimate, respected commentators, you know, columnists, whatever, who would do a far better job in a Republican primary of asking questions relevant to Republican voters than letting this idiot steal the show.
That's a really good point, because, you know, if they were trying to find somebody neutral, why would they want that? Because this is the GOP primary debate.
I don't want neutral. I don't want neutral. And when you I want somebody who's going to ask in a Republican primary about Republican issues, Republican-based issues. And that guy, look, I tend to think, and somebody pointed this out, the debate commission has done a good job over the years of allowing the third parties to participate. They've been very good, and there is a great concern if you let the parties take over the debate, they'll just ice out the libertarians, I mean, who have ballot access. They'll totally do it without hesitation. But the debate commission's got to get their act together, because that was a disgrace.
All right, one more phone call. I don't know, maybe I should save this for when Hammer gets here, but I don't know. You guys had a conversation yesterday, and it was about basketball.
Yeah.
Hey, Casey, I think you need to talk to Rob. They were doing a basketball team for the station, and they didn't mention you. I'm not sure what's up with that, but you may want to discuss that with Rob and Hammer. Thanks, bye.
What happened? What were you guys talking about?
Well, Hammer and I, during the Pacer game, once Nigel had disappeared from our text thread,
of course,
about 8:45 or so, just got on our own little back and forth about if WIBC had a basketball team and they played the Fan, if the Fan had a basketball team, how would this work out?
Okay.
And look,
was I not in the starting lineup? Was I a bench warmer?
Well, you and Katz were sitting on the bench smoking cigars together.
Who's on the IBC team?
Well, it was Kurt Darling, who ran a triathlon. I mean, we went with people who are the most likely to have athletic success. So Kurt Darling was a triathlete.
Okay.
You had John Herrick, because you know Herrick's dad would just scream at him if he played poorly. So we know Bill would motivate John to play well. He's also a giant who would have to match up with Jake Query, who's a giant.
Okay.
We had Hammer on the team, Matt Bear, because of his physical fitness, and then myself were the five that we went with. Let's face it, Casey, we didn't pick you because you're a girl.
Casey could be the head coach.
That's right. I'll be the manager of the team. So let me get this straight. You had Herrick as center.
Yeah.
And what? Kurt and Hammer's forwards?
No, me and Kurt were the guards.
Okay.
Then you had
Hammer and Matt Bear.
Hammer and Matt Bear as the forwards. We think Matt Bear would be like a Rodman, where he could do something insane at any moment.
Right.
And we felt we needed that. Initially, we were going to have Nigel, and then we said, Nigel's too lazy and too drunk to make it through a whole basketball game. So
right.
We had
he's in the pep squad.
Yeah, we had to go. We went with Matt Bear. But you should certainly ask Hammer about that. I think he'll say the same thing I did. We didn't pick you because you're a girl. But ask him that when we come back.
Just for the record, I will. I can box out and pick and roll.
Oh, wonderful. I can't wait to hear this conversation.
It's Kendall and Casey on 93 WIBC. Yeah. Basketball and football. 11 minutes in front of 11 with Kendall and Casey on 93 WIBC. Good morning, Hammer.
So, you're not on the team.
I thought I was on the bench. No, I'm not even on the team.
Because you're a girl.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I'm somebody that feels like protecting women's sports is important.
Thank you.
I'm Team Riley Gaines here.
Yeah, this is for my safety. I appreciate that.
Plus, let's be honest, you smoke so much that I'm concerned that after two or three trips down the floor, you're going to be hacking up black tar and grossing
Matt
everybody
Bear
out.
Matt Bear vapes too. So you're not giving him that.
Well, again, we're not expecting Matt Bear to play big minutes. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a rotation thing between Matt Bear and if you can catch Nige in between naps and sobriety. So we've got that like rotation lineup.
So you got me and Tony Katz on the bench smoking
Tony Katz
cigars.
Didn't make the team.
He didn't. Oh, he's not on the team. No. See, that I'm okay with.
No, no.
Do you think Tony Katz has ever, we asked him this one time. We asked him when he was in here, one of the rare times he showed up to work. I said, have you ever done anything athletic in your whole life? And I thought he said he played soccer in sixth grade.
Yeah.
And that was the extent of it. Now, Herrick did confirm. I talked to John Herrick during the break. He said, yeah, his old man used to rip his ass if he played poorly growing up.
And he's got size, and I really think he could get inside the head of Jake Query in that matchup.
Yeah.
Because, like, halfway through, Query's going to get tired of hearing John Herrick's crap and say, let's just go talk about serial killers and leave.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's what, see, I was right. I said I knew he didn't pick you because you were a girl, and so thank you for confirming that.
It's for my protection.
Yeah. I'm Team Riley Gaines here. Yeah. We're not going to have dudes playing against chicks.
And there are no females at the fans, so.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You want to have a women's basketball team. We won't try to play on that either.
Yeah, it'll be me and Terry Stacy, I guess.
Which I like that two-on-two matchup. Like, I'll take you and Terry against, you know, Annie and Mindy at, you know, Hank and B every single day, twice on Sunday.
Okay.
Draft is tonight.
You love, I love the draft. NFL draft.
My favorite sporting day of the year. I think it's
the greatest. You love it more than the Masters Sunday.
Totally. More than the U.S. Open Sunday. I wait the whole year for the NFL draft because the
Tell me you're a Bears fan without being a Bears fan. That the draft is your favorite night of the year.
Just get months of intrigue. It's like the ultimate chess match. It's like there's all this buildup, but you do all this buildup, but you have no idea what everybody else is going to do, and then you have to respond to what everybody else has to do, and so there's months of preparation, and then it can all change in 1 second, and I love that you got to make trades in like 1 minute, and there's this franchise altering things, and it's just the it's the thinking man sporting event, which is why, of course, it's my favorite thing because nobody thinks more than me.
Did we like the Draft Day movie with Kevin Costner? Was that any good? Did you see it, Casey?
No, I didn't see that.
It was the typical Kevin Costner movie where he's sentimental about a bowel movement. You know, it's just, it's like there's no GM that is actually that way.
What did you think about the Bears unveiling their, you know, proposal for their $4 billion lakefront stadium?
Well, that franchise is a train wreck, and they're going to go all in. It looks like I'm trying to get public financing. Now, the Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives already came out and said this is dead on arrival. So I don't know why they put a plan out that the legislature, which is intricately involved in this,
didn't they already buy a big plot of land like in a suburb?
They did. They bought it. It's, this is the most Chicago Cook County politics thing ever. They buy this old race course in Arlington Heights, which is a suburb. It's like, you know, Carmel to Indianapolis.
And it wasn't cheap.
$197 million. And then the Cook County people, because they wanted them to stay in Chicago, were like, oh, that's cool. We're going to like triple the taxing authority of that land. And the Bears like, well, guess we can't play there either. So guess it's back to Chicago.
So they just wasted $197 million.
I'm gathering you can sell that land to a housing developer or something. I don't know. I just, the whole franchise is a train wreck. This is what happens when you have a 197-year-old woman who owns the team. And it's just, they can't even... There's no way they're getting a $5 billion publicly financed stadium. There's no way.
So what's more dysfunctional? 197-year-old woman running the Chicago Bears or seemingly 197-year-old man being the president of the United States? Which one brings more dysfunction?
You have a theory. You've debated this for years on what the greatest, who would be the highest drafted or best draft pick of fictional football players on the big screen.
Right. We're talking movies, TV shows, you know, books, whatever the case may be. And a hill that I will die on is that the player that has the most upside is quarterback Stan Gable from Adams College in Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah.
Now, hear me out here, because I'm going to take you down a little journey. In the movie, it clearly says, before a pep rally, they're getting ready to introduce their two-time All-American quarterback, Stan Gable. Two-time All-American. Well, this is before a pep rally, before a game, meaning he's in season. They haven't announced the, you know, awards for that current season yet. They happen at the end of the year. And also, in the movie, he's running to be the president of the Greek Council next year, meaning he plans to come back next year. So if he's a two-time All-American quarterback this year with all the things that I mentioned, He was All-American as a freshman. Yeah. A freshman. How many people can go 4 years All-American first team? You can't tell me that that guy doesn't have the most upside of anybody in the draft.
The amount of effort you put into that, like the thought process, it's impressive.
I thought
and
the
disturbing.
Draft was the thinking man's game, Rob.
Do you gamble on the draft hammer?
Oh, I gamble on Russian ping pong, Casey.
What's coming up this afternoon?
So, Judge Mark Stoner and his fine folks at the Indiana Bar Association, they're upset that people want to hold him accountable for his bullcrap. So I'm going to de-pants everybody this afternoon. Put your big boy pants on. Get your seatbelts ready. Hellfire and brimstone.
Thank you. You're listening to Kendall and Casey on 93 WIBC.